Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. We're starting a new chapter called Wonderful Krishna. Sounds like a nice chapter, huh? Text 1, Canto 10, Chapter 26. Shri Shuka Uvacha Evam Vidhani Karmani Gopa Krishnasya Vikshate Atad Virya Vita Prochuhu Samabhyetyas So this mita Evam vidhani karmani Gopa krishnasya vikshate Atad virya vidhak prochuhu Samabhyetya So this mita Shri Sukha Uvacha Evam Vidhani Karmani Gopa Krishnasya Vikshate Atad Virya Vidha Prochuhu Sama vyetya suvismita evam vidhani karmani gopa krishnasya vikshate adhad virya vidha prochuhu sama vyetya suvismita Shri Shoka Uvacha Evam Vidhani Karmani Gopa Krishnasya Vikshate Atad Virya Vidhak Prochuhu Samabhityasu Vismita Shri Shuka Uvacha Evam Vidhani Karmani Gopa Krishnasya Vikshate Atad Virya Vidhak Prochuhu Samabhyetya Suvismita Shri Shuka Uvacha Shri Shukadeva Goswami said, Evam Vidhani, like this, Karmani, activities, Gopa, the cowherd men, Krishnasya, of Lord Krishna, Viksha, seeing, Te, they, atat virya vidha, unable to understand his power, prochuhu. They spoke. Sama vyetya. Approaching Nanda Maharaj. So vismita. Very astonished. Translation, Shukadev Goswami said, the cowherd men were astonished when they saw Krishna's activities, such as lifting Govardhan Hill, unable to understand his transcendental potency. They approached Nanda Maharaj and spoke as follows. I'm going to go back and read the chapter introduction and then the purport. In this chapter, Nanda Maharaj describes Krishna's opulences to the cowherd men as Nanda had heard of them from Garga Muni. Paragraph. The cowherd men, unaware of Lord Krishna's power, were amazed to see his various extraordinary activities. The men approached Nanda Maharaj and told him that after seeing how Krishna, a boy of only 7 years old, had lifted a mountain, and how he had previously killed the demoness Putana and generated extreme attraction in the hearts of everyone in Vrindavan, the men had become doubtful and bewildered about how Sri Krishna could possibly have taken birth in an unsuitable environment of a cowherd community. Nanda replied by relating to them what Garga Muni had told him about Sri Krishna. Paragraph. Garga Muni had said that in the previous 3 ages, Nanda's boy had manifested himself in white, red, and yellow forms, whereas now, in the Dvapara Yuga, he had assumed a darkish blue form, Krishna Rupa. Because he descended as the son of Vasudev, one of his many names is Vasudev, and he has innumerable other names indicating his many qualities and activities. Paragraph. Garga Muni had predicted that Krishna would prevent all sorts of catastrophes in Gokula, spread unlimited auspiciousness, and increase the ecstasy of the cowherd men and women. In a previous age, he had provided protection for the saintly brahmanas when they were harassed by low-class dacoits, and there was no proper ruler in society. As the demons in the higher planetary systems can never defeat the demigods who have Lord Vishnu on their side, no enemy can ever defeat those who love Krishna. In his, that's Krishna's, affinity for his devotees, and in his opulence and power, Krishna is just like Lord Narayana himself. Paragraph. Overjoyed and awestruck by Garga Muni's statements, the cowherd men concluded that Krishna must be an empowered representative of the Supreme Lord Narayana. Thus, they worshipped him and Nanda Maharaj. So that's the chapter summary. Here's the purport for this morning's verse. Text 1, purport. Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur explains this verse as follows. Quote, during Lord Krishna's pastime of lifting Sri Govardhan Hill, the cowherd men simply enjoyed the spiritual bliss of the Lord's activities without analyzing them. But afterwards, when they had returned to their homes, perplexity arose within their hearts. Thus they thought, now we have directly seen Child Krishna lift Govardhan Hill, and we remember how he killed Putana and other demons, extinguishing the forest fire and so on. At the time, we thought that these were extraordinary acts occurred. We thought that these extraordinary acts occurred because of a benediction from the brahmanas or because of Nanda Maharaj's great fortune, or that perhaps this boy had achieved the mercy of Lord Narayana and thus was empowered by him. But all these presumptions are false because an ordinary 7-year-old boy could never hold up the king of mountains for 7 whole days. Krishna is not a human being. He must be the Supreme Lord himself. But on the other hand, Shal Krishna loves it when we coddle him, and he becomes morose when we, his uncles and well-wishers, simply worldly cowherd men, do not give him attention. He appears to become hungry and thirsty, steals yogurt and milk, sometimes plays tricks, tells lies, chatters childishly, and tends the calves. If he is actually the Supreme Lord, why would he do all these things? Don't they indicate that he is an ordinary human child? We are totally unable to establish the truth of his identity. Therefore, let us go and inquire from the highly intelligent king of Vraja, Nanda Maharaj, and he shall free us from our doubts. Unquote. So we're going to hear commentary that's a little different than all of this. According to Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, the cowherd men thus made up their minds, and they entered Nanda Maharaj's great assembly hall and questioned him, as described in the following verse. So off we go to the commentaries. And there's several of them. We'll start with Bhanuswami's translation of Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur. The 26th chapter describes the doubts of the cowherd men about Krishna's powers and Nanda Maharaj reminding them of the words of Garga. Paragraph. Because they were immersed in tasting the sweetness of Krishna while he lifted Govardhan, the opportunity to think about Krishna's extraordinary power did not arise. Afterwards, when they returned to their homes, they all began to have one doubt. Quote, when Krishna previously performed extraordinary activities like killing Putana or swallowing the forest fire, we could think that it was because of the Brahmana's blessings, the good fortune of Nanda, or Narayana entering the boy by his mercy. But seeing Krishna lift Govardhan, such reasoning became useless. It is very astonishing that a 7-year-old boy could lift the biggest mountain for 7 days. It is unimaginable that he can be a human, unquote. In this way, they concluded that he was the Supreme Lord. Quote, but how can it be possible that the Supreme Lord would be pleased to be raised by us, cowherd people with ordinary mother and father, aunt and uncle, and become disturbed if we did not care for him, that he would steal yogurt and milk from hunger and thirst, would blatantly tell lies, and herd the calves? It is not possible that he is the Lord. He is human. We're unable to know the real truth about him. Let us go to the very intelligent king of Russia and have our doubts settled. Thinking in this way, they entered the huge house of Nanda and asked him. Jiva Goswami. This episode takes place in order to increase the prema of the cowherds of Vraja by having Nanda remove their doubts, and in order to remove the worry that their prema would decrease by understanding him as the Lord on seeing such great powers. This continues to the end of the chapter. They saw the most uncommon activities of Krishna, evam vidhani karmani. The plural is used to indicate all the previous incidents. They had not, thought about his powers, since they were famous for always being controlled by their affection for him. Being completely surprised, they approached Nanda with great devotion and spoke with great prema, or showing logic, pra, uchuhu. I'm going to go a little bit forward. This is different. This Jiva Goswami's Priti Sandarbha, so that's the mood. The Lord, full of Param Ishvarya, Param Aishvarya, supreme opulence, acts as Udipan, stimulation, for bhakti, with fear, and gravity as limbs of bhakti. The main element of bhakti, not the limb, is priti, which acts as an udipan for sweetness. The combination of both produces bhakti related to the supremely powerful Lord. Paragraph. It is established that sweetness generates priti. Realization of sweetness is eternally present in Gokula. Realization of Aishwarya is temporary there. After Krishna lifted Govardhan Hill, it is said, quoting this verse, text one, the cowherd men, astonished when they saw Krishna's powerful activities and unable to understand his potency, approached Nanda Maharaj with devotion and spoke with affection. Then going to later in this chapter, dear Nanda, how is that we and all the other residents of Braja cannot give up our constant affection for your son? And how is it that he is so spontaneously attracted to us? Jiva Goswami continues, in answer to the question, Nanda speaks using authoritative words to resolve Krishna's powers. This indicates that sweetness is their permanent realization. Swabhava-siddha, their permanent realization. And then he goes to another verse, and two other verses in this chapter, text 15 and 23. Oh, cowherd men, just hear my words and let all your doubts concerning my son be gone. Some time ago, Garga Muni spoke to me as follows about this boy. Then later in the chapter, after Garga Rishi spoke these words to me and returned home, I began to consider that Krishna, who keeps us free from trouble, is empowered by Narayana. Paragraph. By the words, what Garga spoke to me, Nanda indicates that the conclusion is clear. The word manye, quote, I think, suggests a conjecture. Other words gives the, like Arbhaka and Kumara, suggest his natural appreciation of Krishna's sweetness, taking him as a small boy. Brijbasis. So two more. No, one more. This is another commentary by Vishwanath. A little different than what we read in the BBT purports. This chapter In this chapter, Nanda Maharaj describes Krishna's opulence as he heard of them from Gargamuni in order to remove the doubts of the coward man about Krishna's power. Paragraph. Because all the Vrijvasis were immersed in tasting the sweetness of Krishna while he lifted Govardhan Hill, the opportunity to think about Krishna's astonishing power, maybe we already read this, It's another commentary by Vishwanath. And we didn't already read it, but it's quite similar to the one we already read. Okay. From time to time, a natural question arises. How did the Vrijvasis process the pastimes of Krishna? I mean, they saw, so we commonly say, they were so much covered by the sweetness aspect of Krishna that they didn't even pay attention to the opulence aspect of Krishna. They just thought, how wonderful is Krishna, and moved on. But sometimes, and this is one of those sometimes, there's another time. Another time is when Nanda Maharaj was kidnapped by the agents of Varuna and taken to Varuna's abode. And everyone wanted Krishna to find Nanda Maharaj, so he went to Varuna's abode, and as soon as Varuna saw Krishna and Balaram, he got off his throne and started worshipping Krishna right in front of Nanda Maharaj. So when Nanda Maharaj went back, he had this little discussion with the elders, like, what happened? Who is Krishna? What is his position? There's some things happened. But so, sometimes the curtain is drawn back. And it's very understandable. While they were absorbed in experiencing the sweetness of Krishna for 7 straight days, their mind, their senses, their everything was just absorbed in that. And that happens with us sometimes. We get absorbed in something. We're just kind of oblivious of anything peripheral. And then after the experience, we get back to, what was that all about? So we start, the rational analysis thing starts to happen. So that tendency is being displayed here by the Vrijvasis, particularly these are elders, so they have the privilege to go to Nanda Maharaj. So it's two things. In the commentary, they were hearing how they processed Krishna's other pastimes. Maybe this, maybe that, maybe the other thing. Brahmanas gave a benediction. Nanda Maharaj's piety, something. So something miraculous happened because of some pious credits just went to Krishna and he was protected. Not like he killed this one, killed that one. He just was somehow protected. But this is too much. 7-year-old boy lifting the big hill, the mountain. That's not just, a Brahmana's blessings. So how do we understand it? maybe this, maybe that. We don't understand his opulences. We don't understand his power. We don't understand who he is. Maybe this, maybe that. Maybe he's Narayan. Maybe he's... We can't understand. So they go to Nanda Maharaj. So we're getting this sneak preview, but Nanda Maharaj is not unsettled. Nanda Maharaj has accepted what Garga Muni said. So we're going to, you know, the whole chapter is going into details about it, but you know what Garga Muni said. Your son will be like Narayan. Now Garga Muni knew that he was Narayan, but he didn't want to say that because that would be disturbing to the mood of love of Nanda Maharaj. And who was smart enough to know, don't disturb the mood of love of Nanda Maharaj and the residents of Vrindavan, because it goes from the king to the citizens. So he just spoke about he's like Narayan. And we also hear in these commentaries that we read, he will protect the residents of Vrindavan from calamities. Well, two things. In the world, there's commonly, if not always, some calamity or another. So Krishna protects his devotees from calamities, but protecting his devotees from calamities doesn't mean there won't be coronavirus. Or it doesn't mean that... Printy Menon just shared this with me the other day, because it was her birthday yesterday. And she shared, when she wrote back, that people that know what's going on with her mother are asking Preeti, how is this possible? How can Krishna, your worshipful Lord and Master, allow your mother, who is such a good person, to go through what she's going through? And it's like, very difficult. And you know, Preeti, in her own simple way, said, I told them, Krishna's making an arrangement for her to hear about him before she leaves the world, because he's by her side as much as time permits to chant and read and sound vibration about Krishna before she leaves. So it's making an opportunity for that. That's Preeti's answer to them. But, you know, it's a very unpleasant thing. And let's see what happens when we're on the other side of this coronavirus thing. The way that people live their lives, at least for a while, it's going to change. But most likely, it'll be business as usual after some time. That was my experience, you know, in 9/11. New York became petrified. Just a little sharing. Our bubble of safety has been burst. We're all so vulnerable. Not just we're New Yorkers, but you know what, who can bring harm to New York? But harm came to New York. So there was a scene. I wasn't there. Chandrasekhar Swami was there. He shared with me, they stopped at the stop signs at the crosswalk. New Yorkers don't do that. And not only stopped at the stop signs, but on this corner and that corner and every corner, there was a little shrine where people would offer prayers. And there was this religion, that religion, the other religion, the other religion, all combined with one shrine. On this corner, that corner, the other. And people were like, you know, soft instead of New York. And then at Union Square, the very same place where the Ram Roy and the Harinam Party does what they do. On that southern tip of Union Square Park, groups of people got together. This religion over here, that religion over there, the other religion over there, doing their religious thing. Became like a place where people would pray, they would sing, they would do their thing. And it was, you know, very respectful of one another, but being very religious. People got really religious. They prayed to God a lot. So Chandrasekhar Swami decided that he would just go alone and not even have musical instruments. No, he had harmonium. One person, mat, harmonium, and just chant as people would pass by. And a sign that says, if you want, you know, pastoral counseling between this hour and that hour at 26 Second Avenue, gave the address. So he went there and some people came. So that went on for 30 days, for a whole month. And it was like planned that after 30 days, we'd bring out the first little Harinam party. So some devotees from the temple got mats and sat on the, no standing, sat down. One soft pair of karchals, one softly played mridanga, and acoustical, no amplification, singing. And as soon as the kirtan started, it reminded me of the 60s in going to a park. Washington Square Park was the place at that time where the devotees would go. And there was a big crowd. I mean, the first time I went to New York, I saw that. Devotees chanting in a big crowd. So there was instantly a big crowd. Big crowd. And people in suits, standing very respectfully. One looked like a model, sat down next to the ladies over there, and there's a businessman crying and so forth. It was like people were in a soft-hearted position because of the calamity. And of course, you know, business as usual after some time. It took a while, but calamity helped people turn to God. That's just worldly people. And now coronavirus. I can only imagine what it's like. Besides, it's really quiet on the streets. But people are probably very fearful of their lives and more careful with what they say and do and so forth. Because it's one of the epicenters of deaths. I know two people that work in hospitals in New York. And the whole scene in the hospital is overcrowded and fearful amongst the people that are working in the hospital. So, calamity. Now, so far, I only know of two devotees. A few devotees have been infected with coronavirus. Two of them are elderly here in the United States. And Prajvihari mentioned there's somebody he knows that's an elderly Vaishnav somewhere in Europe. And it's like very terrible. So why is Krishna letting this happen to a devotee? He's going to protect the devotees from calamities. That's what we hear. So when a devotee gets attacked by a calamity, there's not just a silver lining within the cloud, there's an elevation potential within that experience of, you know, sitting straight instead of being complacent, or purification, or taking deeper shelter, or whatever it is. That's Krishna's intention. But the devotee is protected, not in the material necessarily, but in the spiritual sense, protected. That's the promise of Krishna's protection. Not that we'll never get old and never die and never get diseased. Then that's the proof of Krishna's protection. That's not the promise of protection or relieving one of calamity. But in this case, he induced the calamity, he protected during the calamity, and he exchanged in transcendentally blissful ways. And now they're going through this exercise of, who is he? Commentary says, normally they don't go there. The Aishwarya remains concealed. But there are moments when the Aishwarya becomes revealed, I mean, to their consciousness, because otherwise they have some other ways of looking at his opulence. But there are some windows where the curtain grows back and they're looking at, who is he? We don't understand his opulence. Just yesterday evening, we started the Brahma's Prayers, Canto 10, Chapter 14. And that's how the scene opens, because in Chapter 13, Krishna showed his unlimited and inconceivable potencies. And Brahma was overwhelmed. He fell before Krishna like a rod, flat, again and again. And just because Brahma has potencies, gosh, how potent is Brahma's potencies? He created or constructed, he was the engineer of the universe. Who can do that? Not only he understood how to put it together, that's like knowledge, but he had Srishti Shakti. He put it together. So what's the extent of Brahma's potencies? Who can say? And he wanted to see the extent of Krishna's potencies, and Krishna showed him. There's no limit. He showed him. And he accepted that that was Krishna's mercy. So here we have not Brahma, but we have simple cowherd village people wondering, he's got to be divinity. But why would divinity do what he does? Lie, do mischief, steal butter and milk. When we have so much butter and milk, why would he? How to understand? So it looks like ordinary bewilderment, and we should understand it's a type of ecstasy. Just like we were discussing about the bewilderment and ecstasy feature in relation to the Lord's pastime, seeing and... We're getting a look. We'll end here. We're getting a look at the love of the Brijbasis, the love that Nanda has toward his son, Krishna, their appreciation, you know, as the chapter ends, their newfound appreciation of Krishna. It seems that from what we just read, Nanda's conclusion is that Krishna has received some special power. He's like an empowered living entity. Narayan empowered him in certain ways. Powers of Narayan invested in Krishna. And so the conclusion, the cowherd elders, they worship Krishna and Nanda Maharaj as the fortunate father of this empowered personality. Seems like they back off the idea that he's the Lord, but he's empowered by the Lord. It's a natural question when you see extraordinary powers to wonder, wow, where does that come from? How did that happen? So, let's see if there's some discussion. Jitendra, you've got some? Yes, yeah, sure.
I remember in the Srimad Bhagavatam on the back page, I think it's the third canto, part four, people are around a person that's passing away. And it says, Prabhupada says in the purport, he says that when death is around, or that people become philosophical, yeah, and they become reflective. But, I've seen it at funeral services here, mm-hmm, that for a little while, but then they go back to where they're,
yes,
left off.
Yes.
So that just kind of came to my mind. I don't know if you remember that third canto, part four, I think it is, on the back page, when they're all standing around the deathbed. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So that just came to mind.
Mm.
Thank you.
There's one online question from Vibhu Chaitanya Prabhu. For offending Maharaj Ambarish sage, Durvasa had to beg forgiveness from Ambarisha himself to be forgiven by the Lord. Shouldn't that Indra, who sent the rain with intention to kill all the residents of Raja, had to beg forgiveness from them? This is evident from many instances from Lord Chaitanya's pastimes, where even his mother had to beg forgiveness from Advaita Acharya. Is it not that when one offends a Vaishnava, has to beg forgiveness from that Vaishnava, or else Krishna will not forgive? It's a question.
It sounds like he's suggesting that Indra should have gone person by person to all the Brijbasis requesting forgiveness for his offense. And that would mean also the cows and all living entities, because they were all put at risk by Indra's fury. Seems like that's what he's asking. And that without that forgiveness being requested and given, why is it that, will Krishna simply forgive one, by approaching him, all the others automatically will have given their forgiveness. He doesn't have to go and ask all the others. That seems to be his question. Does everybody get that picture? That's his question. Well, two things come to mind. Not necessarily. Let's just say, in the laws of Manu, supposing somebody commits murder and they are to be punished, and they're relieved of that reaction because they were given the death penalty. But the persons who have been affected, not just the one who got killed, but all the persons related to the one who got killed. Now what about all those people? So, that one person that was killed, it's atoned for the one person, but the suffering and inconvenience or whatever else others went through. The main person that Indra was angry with was Krishna. Now, he was, yes, also angry because the Vrijvasis went along with this little boy, but the focus was upon Krishna. So, if Krishna, by approaching Krishna, etc., Krishna's forgiveness, it relieves him of the offense to Krishna. Doesn't mean that the tendency to do other bad things is also now gone, because Indra does bad things from time to time. But the bondage has been fulfilled. It's unrelated, related but not exactly to the point. I've been having some discussion with a GBC member about the Dhruva Maharaj situation, where Vishnu says to Dhruva, your mother and stepbrother are going to die in the following way. And Prabhupada comments in the purport two things: because of the offense to Dhruva, although he was immature and not fully a Vaishnav, the offense was punishable. So the devotee that I've had this dialogue with was asking, well, wait a minute, it looks like Dhruva forgave her. So if Dhruva forgives her, why was she having to undergo some, death, dying in a fire for her offense to Dhruva when he forgave her? That was the essence. And the brother, he was a little boy. What did he do? So there's multiple answers. Something that comes from our acharyas, but to keep it really simple, it's different but similar question in terms of the response. Suruchi, he forgave her. She never apologized. She did say, oh, blessings to you, something like that. But we don't, at least in the text, we don't know what all she said, but there's no indication that she was requesting forgiveness for her severe offense, because pretty severe, and arising out of, her envy and her ambition for her own son. So she never requested forgiveness, although Dhruva forgave. So she's held responsible. So even Dhruva forgave, the Supreme Lord may not have forgiven, because it's like a very serious thing that she did, and she is held accountable. And her malice tendency, who knows what she did in previous lives to bring that about, what she did with Dhruva. So maybe she's being held responsible for those other ones, aside from what Dhruva forgave, or apparently. And one who was very dear to her, her dearest, was her son. And her son not only never became king, but she was deprived of her dearest. And that's what, according to the text, she went mad when her son was killed and she entered into a fire and was burned, because the object of her attachment. So who knows what he did in his previous life to be born of that mother and undergo what he went through, being killed by the yakshas and so on. We don't know the whole picture. Most certainly, the Vrijvasis are moved by love for Krishna. And if Krishna forgives, they forgive. Now, Indra didn't go into the feet of everyone and say, please forgive me, please forgive me. At least we have no indication of that. But their followers of Krishna, they forgave him. And Krishna forgave him. Whereas it seems that Lord Vishnu didn't forgive Suniti. Nor did she ask for forgiveness, to our knowledge. So these things are a little intricate. But if you offend Krishna, you go to Krishna. There may be other persons also affected because you offended Krishna, but you go to Krishna and seek Krishna's forgiveness, however you might want to do that. That's my reply to Vibhu Chaitanya's question. Not completely satisfying, but that's the best I can do. It's a little tricky question.
One more question from online, Guru Maharaj.
Okay.
This is from Joshua Mataji. When a devotee is affected during a calamity situation...
When devotee is confronted...
Affected.
By a calamity situation.
He knows that it is Krishna's plan and he is not exempted from birth, death or disease. When a non-devotee witness this suffering of a devotee, their acceptance in taking shelter is failing. How to give them confidence?
I don't understand the question. Does somebody in the room here understand the question? How to give confidence to non-devotees when they're passing through a calamity? That's the question?
I think it's more than non-devotees, so they don't understand the faith.
Could you give him the microphone so people online can hear? Thanks.
So a devotee who's properly situated will understand that whatever they're going through is the will of the Lord. But
or
when
sanction
you,
at least.
Yes.
Sanction.
It's sanctioned by the will of the Lord.
Yeah.
But when you tell that to a non-devotee, they have a hard time swallowing that. So the question is, how do you instill the faith in people around you that, that's the question.
Even aside from a non-devotee, when Dr. Devotee shared this with me, he's a devotee, Hare Krishna devotee doctor, and he has a medical practice. And his partner in medical practice is a, you know, really sincere, good Christian. And something happened in the life of his partner. His nephew died in some untimely way, I forget what. Whether it was health or car accident or something. And so his partner was asking him, how would God let this happen? And because, you know, he's a good person. My nephew was like a really nice, you know, good person. So how could God let this happen? He wasn't like a faithless man, but it tested his faith. It couldn't figure it out. So they had this discussion. And the simple answer, so supposing it's a non-devotee or, you know, besides a religious person, but not, doesn't really get it. This devotee put it really simply. He said, do you ever make mistakes? Of course I make mistakes. And if you make a mistake, are you responsible for that mistake? You're accountable for your mistakes. It could be even accidental, but if you make a mistake, you're accountable for your mistakes, of course. So similarly, either you or your nephew or combination for certain have made some mistakes and you're accountable for those mistakes. He said, no. How can I be deprived of my nephew because I made some mistakes? You're saying I'm responsible? He's like, got indignant. You know, so that was some years ago, this doctor was sharing, and he's kind of come around to accepting, I'm responsible for my mistakes. Now, that's just a worldly thing. You're responsible for your mistakes. It's not exactly God-centered, but it's you're responsible for your mistakes. In this case, this man is God-centered, so but I'm responsible. I am accountable. Who am I accountable to? To God. So a non-devotee isn't going to say God, but I'm accountable for my mistakes. So if bad things happen to good people, or misfortune or calamity comes to somebody for whatever, it points to the karma principle, which is unpalatable. I'm responsible for my misfortune. So it depends on the person and how you might help them, but most likely, I mean, when 9/11 happened, I forget who it was, the daughter of one of the evangelist Christians gave a little talk on why did it happen. You know, we do these bad things, those bad things, these other bad things, and what do you expect? There's going to be a reaction for our bad things. Or someone sent to me, so I forwarded it around, a letter signed at the bottom. You don't get it, you know, till you read the bottom, but it's signed coronavirus. I was whispering to you about protect the earth, but you didn't hear. I was whispering to you about this, and you know, so misdeeds of people, and you didn't hear. Then I spoke up and said it louder. There was this, and you didn't hear. I spoke louder, and you didn't hear. And you know, so now I put my foot down, and now the air is becoming cleaner in China, and the water is becoming cleaner in Venice because people aren't going around with their gondolas. And now there's, you know, different things. So I hope you've heard. Signed. Now that's not like God, that's coronavirus, but you know, the picture is we're responsible. Why does calamity come? Because we're responsible for our misdeeds. So some people want to say no. So what are you going to do with people that want to say no? I haven't done any misdeeds, or I've done misdeeds, but I'm not responsible for them. So calamity comes. And, you know, step back from the picture. It's the nature of the place. There's good fortune and there's ill fortune or misfortune. And they're sometimes modest, and sometimes it's extreme. And it becomes more extreme, the theistic people understand it becomes more extreme when misconduct or misbehavior or wrong choices are abundant. And it's happening more and more. At least media is letting us know about it as it happens. And there's so much misfortune, not just one thing. So many things. People they have to take responsibility for their misdeeds. So one can say, no, I don't accept it. Okay. Keep doing misdeeds and not feel that you're not responsible, and expect, I'll give you a little prediction. I looked in my crystal ball and you're going to get some reaction for those misdeeds. You're responsible. Okay. Anything else? Yes.
Hare Krishna. I really appreciated the point about how calamities can soften the hearts of people. And like even as devotees, that's the aspiration of a devotee, to soften the heart through bhakti process.
Yeah.
So that inspired me. And also I wanted to share that today Vishwakarma Prabhu passed away 1 year ago. And he was a very humble servant of Kishore Kishori. So
yes.
It's a request for all the devotees, since we are in the temple room in front of Kishore Kishori, please say a prayer for him and his family.
Thank you for that. Jitendra?
You were saying about our consequences. You know, the last sentence of this book, Inglorious Empire, it said, it's about the British Empire. It's written by an Indian politician, but it said, sometimes the best crystal ball is a rear view mirror. So that was the last sentence of the book, and it kind of reflects on what you're saying.
Hare Krishna. Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.